For most, the return to universities and colleges is a big mystery syllabus right now.
I was pretty worried about getting sick. My coworkers did not want to wear masks.
We literally get conflicting emails several times a day about what to expect for the fall semester.
The student and especially faculty and staff health and wellness are not a priority.
Lots of faculty and staff don't feel safe about returning to a campus, but students want to have a traditional college experience.
You're talking to us about it. It's The Takeaway for Wednesday, July 8th, and I'm Matt Katz in for Tanzina today. Also on the show, U.S. judges behaving badly and getting to stay on the bench. And the return of baseball is near, but some players might be hoping for an extended rain delay.
If at any point I start to feel unsafe, if it starts to take a toll on my mental health, you know, then I'll opt out.
With the fall semester approaching, colleges and universities across the U.S. are grappling with when and how to reopen in the upcoming school year, as the coronavirus pandemic shows no sign of slowing down. On Monday, some big names like Princeton, Rutgers, and Harvard announced their classes would be largely online this fall, following a similar decision from the University of Southern California last week. Nationwide, it's a patchwork of different approaches. According to the Chronicle of Higher Education, which has been tracking college reopening plans, about 60% of schools reported that they're planning for in-person classes, with 9% opting for online and 24% turning to a hybrid model for a combination of remote and in-person learning. Some schools are still undecided. And for the colleges and universities that are allowing students and staff back on campus, many are trying to figure out how to do it safely. Whether that means social distancing in the classroom, mandatory mask wearing, or increased testing. If you attend or work at a college or university, do you feel safe heading back to campus? How's your institution handling reopening?
My name is Danae. I'm calling from Boston, Massachusetts. I'm a professor at a New Jersey State University. We've been presented with five options they're calling modalities. They range from campus-based face-to-face to fully online, the latter of which I'm using. Lots of faculty and staff don't feel safe about returning to a campus, but students want to have a traditional college experience.
I worked for a major university in South Carolina. I have pretty severe asthma. I was pretty worried about getting sick. My coworkers did not want to wear masks. I wrote to the president of the university. I asked the president of the university to make masks mandatory. President of the university ignored me. I wrote to the governor. Governor ignored me. I said, I'm not coming back to work if my coworkers don't want to wear masks. I don't want to be around people who aren't wearing masks. So I burned all my vacation time and didn't come to work. When my vacation time ran out, I had to quit. 3 weeks later, the government finally stepped in and made masks mandatory.
Thanks for weighing in at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Now here with us is Bianca Quilantan, higher education reporter at Politico, and Anna Curtis, an associate professor of criminology at the State University of New York at Cortland. Anna, Bianca, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Hello.
Thanks for having me.
So Bianca, let's start with you. What are some of the more common reopening plans that we're seeing from universities and colleges right now?
You know, I think a source kind of framed it the most proper way. He said that colleges have more than just a plan A, B, and C. So there are maybe a dozen ways that schools are reopening this fall. I think the core three, though, are a hybrid model where some classes will be online, some will be in person. And then there's also that starting the semester early, ending by Thanksgiving. And then some are just staying online. I know some universities have also decided to do completely in person, too.
Anna, what about your college, SUNY Cortland? How has SUNY Cortland been thinking about reopening this fall?
So they're doing more of the hybrid model. So some will be online. They have told faculty to split your classes so that only half meets on one day and then the other half meets on another day. And they're intending to end in-person classes at Thanksgiving.
End in-person classes for the semester or for the year?
I don't think for the year. No one is talking about the spring. The last 2 weeks of the semester, everyone will be online, basically finals week. More or less on the assumption a lot of our students are local and they're going to go home for Thanksgiving. And rather than have them all come back, they're just sending them home and having them stay put.
And is there a plan for the spring yet? Or is it assumed that it would look a little lot like the fall, or they haven't even decided yet?
I don't think anyone has decided yet. I would assume that if the fall goes well, we would do it again in the spring. what's going to happen between now and then. Like, who knows?
Totally. Right, exactly. Yeah. Bianca, for those schools that are reopening their campuses, what's their motivation?
I think there are three key motivations. First off, they want students back on campus. I think everyone wants that, but they're still trying to figure out how to do it safely. And then second, mm-hmm. there's revenue losses that they're planning. I think earlier on in the pandemic, some universities were expecting over $1 billion when it comes to their revenue shortfalls. And then they're also seeing budget cuts from state entities. So I think those are the three main motivations, but I guess we'll see how it goes.
So you're saying that they have to bring students back because otherwise they can't charge the same amount of money? Is that what you mean in terms of the financial motivation?
So actually, there's more than just tuition that goes into a college's revenue. You know, there's living in dorms. There is spending money on campus at the bookstore or going to dine in the university. So there's different things in like football seasons, like those are all revenue generators.
So Bianca, what kind of safety measures are being put in place for those colleges that are opening their campuses?
Safety measures are really ranging across the country. Some schools are requiring masks on campus. Some universities that weren't going to require masks, like the University of Georgia, actually just announced this week that they are going to require students to wear masks. But this comes after intense pushback from faculty. And then some others like Purdue University, they bought a mile's worth of plexiglass to protect their professors. So wow. There's a range, yeah.
And will there be testing and contact tracing at colleges as well, Bianca?
You know, contact tracing is probably the most important thing, especially for campus communities. But the CDC actually recommended last week that they don't test every single student. They don't think that is the way to approach it. Some of the larger research universities might be able to have the most ability to do contact tracing, and even some of the small universities. But literally, I think what we need to look at are the resources that each university have, because those resources are going to be what they need in order to implement things like contact tracing.
Anna, you're in the thick of this as a professor at a college. How are you personally feeling about resuming in-person classes?
I mean, I'm pretty nervous on a couple of levels, right? One, I don't really want to be in an enclosed space with a bunch of other people. 18 to 22, I remember that age range. I didn't always make the best decisions. And I think some of our students are going to have a hard time taking this seriously and what it might mean in terms of the exposure to other people. I'm also worried about how we're going to make, like, how I personally am going to meet my childcare responsibilities. You know, my son is in daycare and they're going to be pretty firm about demonstrating illness, which I think they should be. But then, right, like, am I using 6 days? Am I using FMLA? Like, what's the experience going to be like for my students if I'm sort of bouncing in and out of the classroom? It feels like a lot of balls to keep up in the air.
Yeah. And then if you're in the classroom, do the classrooms in your school allow for social distancing? Is that possible when you're in there?
I think we can be 6 feet apart from each other if I only have some of my students, right? If I've got a 35-person class that meets on 2 days and half of them come on Tuesday and half of them come on Thursday, we can probably be 6 feet apart. I'm not sure that's enough indoors. I don't think anybody's sure. And my university is saying that students need to wear masks. I haven't seen anything about what happens if they don't. Am I going to be having some conflict with a maskless student in the middle of my enclosed indoor classroom? That sounds stressful for everybody.
Yeah, so much to think about and worry about. What are you hearing, Anna, from students and non-faculty staff and other faculty, too, about the reopening plans? Are you hearing similar concerns?
So certainly from other faculty and staff who I interact with the most in the summertime, I'm hearing less from students just because of the distance. Many of my students are focused on earning money and keeping their families afloat. That's certainly the main concern I heard in the spring as we were sort of dealing with this outbreak. I've heard of a couple of students contacting their professors being like, hey, I have a kid, like, can I just do this online? Like, will you work with me? That's the thing I've heard the most. The staff and other faculty are also worried, at least the ones I have talked to, and feeling concerned about how we're going to really successfully put these security practices or safety practices into reality. you know, I think our administration is trying to figure it out. They want to bring the students back. They're worried about the finances. I don't want people to get fired, but I also don't really want to have a COVID outbreak in Cortland. It sounds potentially avoidable.
Yeah, you're worried about the wider community being affected by this beyond the college, I guess, right?
Definitely. We're a small rural town. Like, we do actually have a hospital in Cortland, but it doesn't have anywhere near the capacity to deal with a real outbreak. And thus far, we've had 54 cases. I'm just not sure our infrastructure is ready for this.
Bianca, are we seeing colleges rethink tuition? What is going to happen with tuition here in light of these various models for reopening?
Princeton University announced on Monday that it will cut 10% of tuition in the coming year, but a lot of universities are staying firm in their tuition. Early on in the pandemic, we saw a lot of class action lawsuits, but I spoke to a lawyer who represents universities, and he said that he believes institutions have a strong defense to all of those claims, but he can see a practical appeal of room and board claims or student fee claims because they're not delivering on their contract. So when it comes to tuition claims, I think, you know, lawyers who are representing universities say that it's going to be really hard to prove student damages because it comes down to how do you quantify the difference between an in-person class and an online class? How do you put a specific dollar value on that? From a breach of contract standpoint, the basic agreement is I pay tuition and I satisfy my academic obligations and you give me credits. And that's still going to happen this fall.
I assume for those who are returning to campus this year, no keggers, party life, cultural life, that kind of cultural life on campus is done for the year?
You know, I think it's fair to say that students will experience a very limited college life. Can college students follow the rules? And, you know, if you look on Twitter, everyone's like, yeah, right. I don't know if we can expect students not to be college students.
Mm-hmm. Bianca Kilantan is a higher education reporter at Politico, and Anna Curtis is associate professor of criminology at the State University of New York in Cortland. Anna, Bianca, thanks so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
My name is Beth, and I'm from Fall River, Massachusetts. I work at a community college nearby me in Fall River, Massachusetts, a working class city. We are going to be mostly remote in the fall, but there will be some hybrid classes, especially to service students taking classes with labs associated with them, but most of the options are going to be online. I work with students with disabilities, and we've been quite impacted. Even though I can work remotely, a lot of students with disabilities don't have the technology in their homes to access content fairly, and that created some new issues.
Hi, I'm Ryan from St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm a professor at a small liberal arts college, and I fear that our university leadership is in denial about the coming semester. I'm concerned that the very real financial concerns are completely driving the decision-making and that the student and especially faculty and staff health and wellness are not a priority.
This is Lisa from Rainham, Massachusetts. I'm a faculty member who is a full-time faculty at a community college in Massachusetts. And I am really pleased with the leadership role that our president has taken in this issue in COVID. He has gone with making the college entirely remote and online with a few very limited exceptions. And I think that is the smart thing to do for the fall.
My name is Jennifer, and I am calling from Texas, where I'm a professor. And we literally get conflicting emails several times a day about what to expect for the fall semester. I do know it will be my job to enforce social distancing and mask wearing. I can't even get them to quit buying research papers and prepare for their exams, so I'm not sure I can actually enforce anything.
The national conversation around racial justice is calling for police accountability throughout the U.S. Now a new investigation highlights questions of accountability in another branch of the criminal justice system, the courts. Across the country, thousands of judges have track records of unethical or illegal behavior while on the bench. Yet the majority of those who have been investigated and found to be guilty of misconduct continue to serve. That's according to a year-long investigation from Reuters. In the past 12 years, thousands of judges have only received slaps on the wrist for misconduct that has left thousands of people to suffer the consequences of their actions. I spoke with Michael Behrens, an investigative reporter for Reuters, on their year-long investigation documenting instances of judicial misconduct throughout the U.S.
What we endeavor to do is to quantify the situation. So when I began with one state, let's take New York, for instance. It's a very transparent state when it comes to judicial misconduct. They have a wonderful website, and you can go look up all the judges who've been adjudicated or found to have committed an ethical breach or, you know, a violation of law. And in other states, we found absolutely zero information publicly available or readily available. And that's when we started getting more and more interested. Like, some states do a good job, some states don't. And we started counting up, well, how many judges each year have been found to have committed some level of misconduct? And the numbers started to become staggering. You know, first it was dozens and hundreds and thousands.
Wow. So give us an idea of the type of misconduct we're talking about. Is it personal actions related to their work as judges, both?
It's a vast array, but what we focused on in this first story are judges who committed misconduct who stayed on the bench. And let me give you a sample. I mean, we focused on a Utah judge who was texting pictures of male private parts to his clerks, a Texas judge who burst into a jury room on a sex traffic case and told the jury that God had told him that the defendant was innocent and that's the way they should go. There's a California judge who had sex in his chambers with female attorneys. There's a New York judge who was berating domestic violence victims, a Maryland judge who had gotten busted for DUI, for drunken driving, and his condition was so bad that every day before he took the bench, he was required to take a breathalyzer. And then a Tennessee judge who signed an order that would allow women out of jail early if they agreed to a surgical birth control implant, and for the men, if they would get a vasectomy. And so what we found is that all these judges returned to the bench despite these infractions. And overall, what we found is that 9 of every 10 judges who are adjudicated or found to have committed misconduct are allowed to return to the bench.
And we're talking total, like, thousands of judges here that we're speaking of that you looked at.
Yes. And the way we got to thousands is, you know, one of our surprising findings is we found 1,509 judges who had been publicly disciplined. But what really astounded us is we found 3,613 judges who had been privately disciplined across 38 states. And this opened up a whole new realm for us that states were privately disciplining judges for serious infractions at times and not telling the public anything about it.
And now on the flip side, you have victims of this misconduct. Can you tell us about the victims, the people who are harmed by the actions of these judges?
I'm glad you asked about that, because I think that is one of the most important aspects of what we tried to bring to light, is while we focus on the actions of the judges, and that's what makes the headlines, often very little attention is paid to the people who were hurt by these actions. So of the 1,509 public cases, we compiled documentation for each and every case, and then we poured through it trying to determine if there was a way to find out how many victims were impacted. Of those cases, we did identify 5,206 victims, people who suffered as a consequence, people who were unlawfully jailed, people whose cases languished for years and their children stayed in foster care. And we found that really became sort of the social mission of this story, was to give voice to these victims.
Can you share us the story of Marquita Johnson and her experience in Alabama?
So Marquita is a Black woman in Montgomery, Alabama. She's living in a neighborhood, in an impoverished neighborhood, and the police set up roadblocks in the neighborhood. They're pulling people over for everything. And according to the people we talked to, when they got stopped, they would not just get one ticket, they would get 2 or 3 tickets. They called it stacking. And although each ticket was not that expensive, the court levied, you know, $100 to $150 court cost on every ticket. So a single traffic stop could easily cost you $500. In Marquita's case, she racked up some tickets trying to take her kids to school, trying to go to the store, and she fell behind. She owed thousands of dollars to the court. What's tragic about Marquita is she went to the court and said, "I've just lost my job. I need more time to pay." And instead, a judge there sentenced her to 496 days in jail. Wow. For failure to pay traffic tickets. This is a woman who's never committed a crime. Her only infraction, if you want to call it that, was failure to pay a traffic ticket. 496 days in jail. And the conditions in this city jail was horrific at times. What they made the prisoners do labor to work off their fines, you know, cleaning up blood, you know, in cells and washing police cars, even cleaning the courtrooms. And the irony is that the time that she got for failure to pay a traffic ticket exceeded the jail time that Alabama allows for negligent homicide. I mean, this is how unfair and unequal the system is.
And what happened to the judge? The judge got away with just exacting this punishment on this woman for traffic violations?
He didn't get completely away with it, but he went right back to the bench after he was chastised for breaking state and federal laws, for basically breaking every ethical oath, you know, that every judge takes. And this was the irony. Judge Hayes had spent a decade on the bench and had jailed countless Marquita Johnsons. The stories are just legion. But when complaints were filed against him and when he finally was suspended for 11 months, when he came back to the city, they hired him right back in a very contentious city hall meeting. Black residents are appearing before city council and say, you cannot hire this guy back, you know, not after everything he's done. And the city hired him right back.
Who's in charge of oversight here in various jurisdictions? Who's in charge of investigating and disciplining judges accused of misconduct?
Every state has what's called a judicial oversight agency. Sometimes they're called commissions. Every state has a different name. And these state agencies or commissions receive complaints about judges, investigate those complaints, and then there's a process for initiating action against judges. The irony is that most of the disciplinary actions are little more than written warnings. Sometimes they're called a reprimand. Sometimes they're called a censure. Sometimes they're called an admonishment. But it's little more than just a piece of paper that says, please don't do this again. But at least there is a process that most people aren't aware of, that you can file a complaint against a judge. And it's supposed to be investigated if it's a valid complaint.
Do you have any revelations after working on the story for about a year, just about the criminal justice system and about how we select and elect and appoint judges in this country?
Wow, that's a huge can of worms, you know, a huge debate on election versus appointment.
Sure.
And I don't have, I think, any significant insight into whether an appointed judge or an elected judge is a better thing. I think there's a lot of valid issues about elections and judges who are beholden to campaign financing and to donors. We saw a lot of violations involving judges with campaign violations and conflicts of interest. So that certainly does raise a lot of issues. I think the issue that sort of popped out to me wasn't something that was consistent, but it was the inconsistency of the justice system. I mean, you take New York, for instance, you've got full-time judges, you've got part-time judges, you've got thousands of judges in New York who don't have law degrees, which I found amazing. I didn't realize it was so easy to become a judge in so many different jurisdictions. And then you have public discipline and you have private discipline. New York, from what our calculations are, has hundreds of cases of private discipline. Many states say, you know, we reserve private discipline for our most minor cases that don't deserve, you know, full public airing. But we have to take the word of the state for that. And some states, you know, I think we've been able to show aren't as faithful to that. You know, in New York, you also have judges who are allowed to resign or retire and their investigation is stopped. And this is common across the country as well. But I think we found 191 judges in New York who agreed to leave the bench, which prematurely shut down the investigation, also stunted public disclosure. So that's, I think, the surprising thing. Every state operates differently, but a lot of it's behind this shield of secrecy and silence.
Michael Behrens, investigative reporter for Reuters. Mike, thank you for your investigation, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for putting a light on this important information. Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%.
All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Texas doctors confront the reality of the abortion ban.
A violation of the law could result in a first-degree felony charge and a fine of at least $100,000. After Roe was overturned, the message from doctors was, I'm out of here.
Revisiting the abortion laws in Texas. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The coronavirus pandemic and the protests for racial equality are forcing many of us to reassess the role technology and surveillance play in our lives. We've been talking about all of this on the show, from contact tracing to Facebook ad boycotts to facial recognition technology. And now we're going to go a little deeper into one perspective on how social media in particular marks our lives and how it got this way. The 2016 election and its aftermath put a spotlight on the ability of social media to not only affect civil discourse, but to affect an election and impact democracy as we know it. That is a lot of power.
What's happened is that the systems have taken over every domain of life. This stuff is ubiquitous, and it has increasingly put us in a situation of no escape.
That's Shoshana Zuboff, author of The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power, and a professor emerita at Harvard Business School. She thinks a lot about how technology affects us.
What happens to human beings in that kind of situation is you get resigned, you feel helpless, and you start to create these defense mechanisms to sort of, you know, prevent you from feeling the full weight of how intolerable this is. And those defense mechanisms look like habituation. You know, you just kind of stop really noticing and reacting.
She says that many of the privacy issues that today plague the internet can be traced back to the aftermath of 9/11.
Even on September 10th, if you were hanging around Capitol Hill and people were talking about the internet, the debates were about having comprehensive privacy legislation, because the folks from the FTC and within Congress already understood that these fledgling companies, these genius startups in Silicon Valley, they were already developing these secret monitoring and surveillance tools of users, things that now we consider pretty benign, you know, web bugs, cookies. And they understood that this fledgling industry was not going to be able to self-regulate. There were going to need to be laws. Now, September 11th, everything changed. The focus shift from privacy on the internet to total information awareness. And the political shift there is that suddenly these fledgling companies that were threats to privacy and everything that privacy represents to us, human autonomy, human agency, and so forth, suddenly these companies were reimagined. Now they were going to be the heroes who were going to march us into the 21st century, and they were going to provide the government, its intelligence agencies, the Defense Department, they were going to provide the government with the data flows that it needed to achieve total information awareness outside of the Constitution and without any new laws coming on stream to really impede them. They were encouraged to develop these new systems that take our private experience as free raw material that's repurposed as behavioral data, which they then claim is proprietary. That then they say they own it. And with their owning these behavioral data streams, they turn them into computations, they sell them, and that's how they have become information empires.
It's that system that's allowed privacy breaches and the misuse of data that companies like Cambridge Analytica have used to detrimental effect. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has continued to apologize for his company's mistakes and misuse of data. Here he is during a congressional testimony in 2018.
Facebook is an idealistic and optimistic company. For most of our existence, we focused on all of the good that connecting people can do. And as Facebook has grown, people everywhere have gotten a powerful new tool for staying connected to the people they love, for making their voices heard, and for building communities and businesses. But it's clear now that we didn't do enough to prevent these tools from being used for harm as well. And that goes for fake news, for foreign interference in elections and hate speech, as well as developers and data privacy. We didn't take a broad enough view of our responsibility, and that was a big mistake. And it was my mistake, and I'm sorry.
For the last 20 years, we have operated on this assumption that we were going to let these companies self-regulate. You know, we thought that these were good, innovative companies who occasionally made mistakes that violated our privacy, when the actual truth is, and we've slowly come to understand this, that those mistakes that violate our privacy are the innovations. They're not mistakes. That's the thing that they do. That's the thing they excel at. And they have driven that to a frontier that was unimaginable 20 years ago.
Zuboff told us she's positive about the future, though. She sees the recent Facebook ad boycotts and Zoom privacy scandals as signs that people are ready to push for new internet laws and regulations that would prevent invasions of privacy and hate speech.
The good news is that because of this intensification and amplification, because of the way this is now, you know, taking over all of our lives, and as we lose the social and the physical dimensions of our lives, we are all becoming alert to this in a new and fresh and sharp and painful way. So we're kind of, you know, breaking through that fog of habituation and normalization and those defense mechanisms and the resignation that we got used to, the sense of helplessness and inevitability. And now there is a sense of the intolerable nature of these circumstances. We're talking about it. We're talking about it right here on this show, but people are talking about it everywhere.
Shoshana Zuboff is a professor emerita at Harvard Business School and the author of The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. All right, folks, we've talked a lot on the show about how hard it is to be a parent right now. Trust me, I have two elementary school kids, I know. Now schools are talking about their reopening plans for the fall, and many families are facing the very real possibility of more remote learning, at least part-time. Kids across the U.S. have already spent months learning remotely, which in most cases has meant a lot less focused learning time, and schools and families having to adjust their expectations for the upcoming year. We asked you to reflect on how you feel about your child's progress during the pandemic and what effect remote learning has had on your child so far.
My name is Debbie. I'm calling from a suburb of Portland, Oregon, and it actually breaks my heart, but my kids' learning has pretty much completely stalled. The remote learning was minimal, and I tried to supplement, but I have a tween and a teen, and if it doesn't come from a teacher, it doesn't matter to them, and I can't get them to engage, and they've completely dropped off and are pretty much consumed with technology. I feel guilt as a parent, but also resignation. It's just super, super sad. I'm working from home. My husband's working from home, and how can we keep everything going? It's basically the kids are Lord of the Flies, and there's not a whole lot we can do.
I'm calling from Salem, Mass. My name's Brad. We've seen tremendous growth with our kids over the past couple months. Like, we never would have imagined that our kids were capable of learning so quickly. The only thing we're worried about is social interactions with other kids. You know, socializing kids is a difficult process and one of the more important processes to growing up. So we're going to send them to the Y after school programs just for that social time with other kids. We don't plan on sending them back to school at all, really. So that will be the only play time and interaction time with other kids.
My name is Constance Beluska, and I'm calling out of Columbia, Kentucky. Honestly, my daughter has done extremely well with remote learning. She's free from distraction and can move at her own pace through the work. I know she may be missing some of the information that only her educators can provide, but she has more success in that remote online environment than in a traditional class setting. If I had more time to dedicate to it, I would move her to a homeschool setting to continue that purposefully.
This is Matthew calling from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. My middle child was in his freshman year of college and dropped from a 3.75 to a 2.25 with no factor substantially changing other than that halfway through the semester, they sent everybody home and made them learn online. He does a whole lot better in a group setting or where he can learn from the other students as well as the teacher. And he fell behind and was never able to catch up. If they don't go back to a classroom setting in the fall, he's talking about taking a semester off or even a year, which I'm reluctant to have him do because a ridiculous number of people don't return after taking time off. And I'm afraid he would fall into that group.
My name is Jennifer. I'm calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I actually feel great about my child's progress. Her teachers did not skip a beat in the transition to online learning, and I do not think her academics suffered at all.
My name is Rosemary, and I live in Dingman's Ferry, Pennsylvania, even though I teach in New Jersey. I find that remote learning for my child has been ineffective. He's also suffered from a lack of social interaction. However, as a teacher also, I really don't see any safe alternative because the recommendations coming out for fall are woefully impractical.
This is Faye from Alta Loma, and in my opinion, it's busy work. It's not real learning. It's like packet work. I'm a teacher, and I did it differently with my students, so I hope they got more out of it than my son did.
So the children's, you know, school progress during the pandemic for me was perhaps a fault of mine, but at home, the interest dwindled after an hour or so. Kids often follow each other, right? So when mine is in school, he does as he's expected to with the rest of the class, always had good reports, but I call it herd learning, and just it's not working at home.
This is Frankie in Portland. For my preschooler, it's not the content loss I worry about. That I can replace. Rather, it's the lack of social connection with her peers. As she develops, she needs peer interaction more than just parents.
Thanks, as always, for weighing in and sharing your experiences. Tell us your thoughts about remote learning for your children by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE. It's The Takeaway. The coronavirus continues to spread across the country, but that doesn't seem to be holding back Major League Baseball from pushing towards their mutated 2020 season. Now down to 60 games from the normal 162, with all sorts of new rules and conditions. But not everyone is ready to play ball.
We're trying to bring baseball back during a pandemic that's killed 130,000 people. We're way worse off as a country than where we were in March when we shut this thing down. And like, look at where other developed countries are in their response to this. We haven't done any of the things that other countries have done to bring sports back. Sports are like the reward of a functional society. And we're just like trying to just bring it back, even though we've taken none of the steps to flatten the curve.
That's Sean Doolittle, pitcher for the World Series champs, the Washington Nationals. He's not the only one who's skeptical about playing this season. So far, 9 players have opted out altogether, including Dodgers superstar pitcher David Price. Some teams have delayed training due to a lack of testing. And unfortunately, 31 players and 7 staff members have tested positive for the virus. All of those factors just might put a hiccup in the season's start. Here with us is Jane McManus, the director of the Maris Center for Sports Communication and sports columnist for the New York Daily News. Jane, good to have you back.
Oh, thanks for having me, Matt. Appreciate it.
Sure thing. So tell me what this modified season is supposed to look like.
I think ideally, when it was first envisioned, it was going to be something that could be fairly well contained. A lot of testing would be involved. Major League Baseball even contracted with a lab in Utah to do all of the testing. And the idea was tested every 2 days, 24 hours turnaround. And I think what's happening is that the ideal of a brief season that says sports is back
has actually run into the reality of, you know, what Sean Doolittle said, which is a society that isn't functioning very well. They're having difficulty just getting these tests to the lab to be tested, and the turnaround is taking 7 days. And I think if you look around at the larger culture at large, you have states where it's very difficult for people to get testing. So there's this contrast between baseball players getting tested every 2 days and these long lines of cars at these drive up testing stations in places like Texas and Florida, where it's very difficult to get the testing. And it's just kind of, instead of showing the way that the United States can come back from something difficult like the coronavirus, it's actually showing quite the opposite.
Yeah, and they're supposed to be doing opening day July 23rd and 24th, and that's just around the corner. What are some of the other weird new rules that the MLB is imposing for this 60-game season?
Well, there's the universal designated hitter, which is, was jarring for some people to to take. But yeah, that's one of the rules that there's going to be. I think just the whole idea of the structure of the season, you have certain players who've come out and said that they're not sure, what it'll mean to necessarily make the playoffs or to win a World Series this year, and that's going to be a lot different just because baseball is a sport that really is about, it's a marathon, right? You have 162 games. It's about going from city to city to city to city to play, three game stands, whatever. And now it's going to look very, very different. And so I think it's just kind of, how does this season even fit into the record book necessarily, where baseball is so used to having everything be regular and all of these stats and everything, and it's just going to look very different.
Right. And I understand they also want a player on second base to begin the extra innings. And then the rule that really caught my eye was no spitting. Is that real? Are they going to enforce that? I mean, what happens if you spit?
A penalty? I don't know. You have to take a lap.
Yeah.
I think that this is all very much, I think you're just supposed to not spit. Maybe not throw the Gatorade either when you get angry.
Right.
But I think there are a lot of these things that are going to have to be instituted for baseball, just like they're going to have to be instituted in Little League, and they're going to have to be instituted across the country. And the idea, I think, is partially that you want to set some sort of example of how everybody else will be able to play baseball if they want to play baseball, right? And because we as a culture are going to have to do a lot of social distancing if we want to come back. And the idea of maybe when you're going over lineups, when you're sitting in a dugout, maybe not sitting quite so close, physical contact, that kind of thing. I mean, within the world of baseball, yes, you're going to have testing, which obviously there are lots of debates about whether or not that's happening in a functional enough way to be able to get the sport back. But at the same time, I think there is this idea that, they're trying to set the tone, right, for sports to
right,
be able
sure.
to come back. And how does one do that in a responsible way?
For the guys who are opting out of playing this season, what are they saying? What are their reasons?
Well, a lot of them are talking about, either they have small kids, some of them have kids with pre-existing conditions, some of them have family members, some of them are personally have, this is the other thing, is that I think there's this assumption culturally that a lot of players are going to be just fine if they get it, they're young, they're healthy. But, there are a lot of players, not just in baseball, but across professional sports that do have underlying conditions that they've been able to manage and play with really successfully. Like, sickle cell trait in the NFL, I know a couple of players have that. There's asthma. There are a couple of players who've been able to play with that. And the idea then that they're going to be just fine, well, they know the picture of their health. They may not talk about it publicly. It may not be part of their public profile or on their baseball card, but they know what it is. And they have to make those decisions kind of with that in mind. And it's not a no-brainer for everyone. And I think there are a couple of players, that we've heard who actually gave this some thought and have kind of are wrestling with it in real time. Like, they're willing to give it a shot. They're willing to see if baseball can get the testing process right. But if they can't, I think you might see more and more players feel like it's not a safe enough environment for them to return to, because they're not in a bubble. When they're home, they can go home and hang out with their kids and hang out with their grandparents and hang out with their wives. And that is the kind of thing where there is not zero risk. And so there's not zero risk to their families. And, the idea is they are actually going to be going from stadium to stadium. So traveling on buses to get to games, traveling on airplanes to get to stadiums, all of this is going to be happening. So the same issues that you would have traveling for your summer vacation and deciding whether or not to take a plane, they're going to be taking, they're going to be taking these decisions and these risks to play a season. And so it's not foolproof. And I think more and more players are going to start really having to, when the rubber meets the road here, decide whether or not they're going to stay in.
What about stadium staff and the less visible people in the baseball infrastructure? Have they been speaking up about whether they want to stay home or get back to work? Because they're, you know, equally at risk, right?
They would be equally at risk. And this is part of the, you know, I haven't necessarily seen any reporting specifically on that, but it's certainly a consideration. And, you know, you think about essential workers, for example, and how many of them have become ill. And how many people who work in close quarters in meatpacking plants, for example, or in warehouses have become ill. And it's not something, I think the medical concerns are different. If some, a lot of these people who have these jobs are seasonal employees, so the healthcare that they might have access to could be very different. And I think those are, you know, just like in our regular economy, those are kind of the unheard voices, but often the people who bear the brunt of the risk.
Sure. And they won't get paid, I imagine. Many of these people, if the things get worse and the season ends up being canceled, their livelihoods are at risk, I imagine, right?
That's right. And some teams, you know, part of the reason that some of the teams applied for the PPP program federally was to be able to protect the wages of those employees who work in stadiums. Some teams have opted to continue paying people and some have not. You know, it's one of those situations where it's very tricky. How are you treating the employees who have been there every single year and do the kind of unheralded jobs, which would be very risky? I mean, you talk about, you know, cleaning a locker room. Are they going to have the same sort of testing available to them, sure, for example?
On the other side of the spectrum for the owners, can we put a dollar value roughly on how much a season, if it is canceled, if it ends up being canceled, how much that would cost ownership and baseball in general?
So baseball stands to lose money anyway, just based on the shortness of the season and also based on the fact that about 40% of baseball's revenue is via gate, which means that, you know, fans coming in through the gate to sit in the seats. And that's obviously money that's not going to be there this season. So they're already looking at a loss. A lot of teams also have stake or own outright the broadcast, local broadcast networks that show every single game. And, you know, most towns have these. You'll know it because they're always playing baseball games all year long, and a lot of replays of games as well. That's another area of, you know, kind of financial, where they could take a hit financially.
And I've been talking hypothetically about a canceled season. I mean, is that a possibility at this point, considering the difficulty in starting this thing up?
I think it is definitely a possibility. And I'll say that because out of all of the professional sports league, there's the least amount of trust between the baseball players and the baseball owners. And I think that you saw that in how difficult it was for them to come to some sort of financial agreement, you know, where they get 37% of their pay for playing 37% of the season. And just even coming to that kind of an arrangement was really challenging. So I think that the idea that the plans to keep players safe, if they're not trusting the owners to be able to do that, I do think you're going to see more and more players wonder if it's worth it.
If they only play 60 of 162 games, are the statistics, the lifeblood of baseball, are they legitimate? And would the ultimate World Series winners be seen in baseball history as legitimate champions?
You know, I have to think that they really wouldn't. You know, there are a number of, you know, people have kind of like done different dissections of why that's the case. For example, looking at teams who've had hot streaks late in the season and ended up, you know, making it to the playoffs and winning the World Series. So if you'd ended the season at 60 games, there are a lot of World Series winners who would not have ended up being competitive at that point. And so it's this idea of streaks and getting hot and, you know, pitchers getting, you know, better as the season goes along and kind of creating the space for that to happen.
Right.
And that's just not something that would happen this year. So I think, you know, also when you're looking at stuff like the DH and when you're looking at some of those rules changes, you know, it's going to be so different. It's really, it would be apples to oranges when it comes to the record book. And, you know, it might be something, you know, like an interesting kind of, hey, remember when, or did you know, one of
right.
those
yeah,
kind of
sure.
crazy facts, right, that they pull out. But I don't see how you could actually compare it. It's such an unusual environment. The best players, a lot of them, like David Price, you know, isn't playing. So how are you going to be, you know, the competition in the field isn't going to be the same for the hitters, you know? So it's going to look so different, I think. Rosters are different, you know. I just don't see how you really compare the two.
Okay, Jane, my last question is a personal one. Do my Mets have a better or worse chance of winning the World Series in a shortened season?
I mean,
can you give me any answer on that?
I have to say, like, I look at all of the, I know this is going to sound like a cop-out, and maybe it is, but I have to look at all of these projections, like, you know, lineups, this first lineup versus that lineup. And it all feels extremely hypothetical to me at this point, because it just feels like the baseball season is almost imaginary. And I just don't even see necessarily how they get on the field.
Wow. Well, I guess I'll just be playing baseball on my Nintendo Switch then, if that's the case.
So, you know what? As long as you're seated 6 feet away from the person that you're playing against,
right.
I think that's a better idea.
Very true. Jane McManus, director of the Marist Center for Sports Communication and sports columnist for the New York Daily News. Jane, thanks a lot for joining me.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
That's our show for today. Always good to be here with you guys. If you want, you can follow me on Twitter at MattKatz00, MattKatz00. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.